Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, our independent financial advisor, Nick Bruning, is back on Nightlife tonight. If you've got a question about how to get the most out of your money, give us a call. All advice is general, of course, but with that standard caveat. Nick, welcome back.
Hello, Philip. Yes, lovely to be here.
Terrific to have you with us as well. We'll get to some calls in a minute, but first I wanted to take a look at this report that's come out from the Australian National University that's raised some serious concerns about the massive rise in the number of so-called sophisticated investors. Now, what's this about and why does it matter?
Well, Phil, it's really, really important because the sophisticated investor tag or label, if you like, basically means that you can access investments which are regarded as wholesale type investments. So they're kind of pitched at the really big end of town, the super funds themselves and whatever. Now, around about 30 years ago, the definition came out, wholesale versus retail investment, and it got refined 20 or so years ago and set some monetary thresholds which were based back to that 1991 level. So we're talking about a time when teenage mutant ninja turtles were running around on TV and Bob Hawke was in the lodge. That's how far back we're talking. So those values that are still being used today go back to 1990, 1991. And what we're talking about is a sophisticated investor basically is someone that can access these wholesale type investments. Importantly, they bypass many of the protections that are there to stop us investing in dud investments, quite simply. So things like the disclosure of risks and commissions. And probably the most significant thing is that when you're dealing with a financial advisor on a retail level, that person must act in the client's best interests. Now, none of that applies to sophisticated investors. And I suppose if you want to see the sort of the workings of that, very sadly, we've got Mayfair 101 with something like $200 million of funds frozen. Most of those investments were done on the back of the sophisticated investor thing. So you end up being able to invest without getting a statement of advice, without getting the report that sets out all the risks and things. And what this report's come up with in the last couple of weeks, conducted by Ben Phillips, who's an associate professor at ANU, is, as you said, we were currently looking at 3.2 million. Now, when this was first set, there were only 285,000 Australians that qualified for the sophisticated investor thing. And the test is income of 250,000 over the last 2 years. Okay, not many people perhaps qualify for that. But the one that will capture many is the test that says $2.5 million in net assets. So, you know, if you own a 3x2 in Sydney, you're probably there at the 2.5 million threshold already.
Well, you would be.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is why it's so terrifying is that 3.2 million, it gets to 6.78 million in 2041 and 11.5 million in a few years after that. So, you know, we're talking almost a third of the population being exempt from having to get protections that are there to design them from getting ripped off. So there's been a bit of a call out to increase this threshold. In fact, the irony is,
that's the answer. I mean, that's what's happened.
Well, why don't they index it?
They should index the threshold because, I mean, the reason there are more sophisticated investors is simply that people's assets have risen and therefore everyone's more people are in the net, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And what's extraordinary is the government seems, for some reason, pushing back against this. You've got the Financial Services Council, who's like the representative body who of anyone would be fighting to keep it down, arguing that it should be doubled to 5 million from the 2.5 million net asset test. And it's all about protecting people. I mean, we've just had a Royal Commission in dodgy financial advice. You'd think that they'd be pulling out all the stops to protect people. Mm. And, you know, the counter-argument is, oh, well, we've got to do all this paperwork. It adds to the expenses and stuff. Well, yeah, maybe it does. But I tell you what, I'd much rather have to pay a couple of $1,000 and lose a quarter of a million to make sure that I'm protected.
Well, agreed. Exactly. All right. Now, changing expenses in retirement. The big question that we've had this conversation here many times, haven't we? How much do you need in retirement? But are you making a mistake if you're looking for a single figure that remains the same from the day you turn 65 until the moment you jump off the twig?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's something we have touched about before, but I guess it came up after the last show we did, where we were talking to a couple of our callers about, you know, how much do you actually need? Mm. And look, I just remind people that when you move from work to retirement, what we tend to find is that your expenses stay pretty much the same, okay? So whatever you're doing just before retirement in terms of going out and the lifestyle doesn't shift that much once you're actually in retirement. If anything, it comes down a little bit because you don't have the expenses associated with work, like parking and maybe clothing and those sorts of things. Then it sort of it does go up, and there's no question that as you get older and you go through those early years of retirement, indexation applies, and we've got CPI and all that sort of stuff. But very interesting, Phil, a couple of things will happen. As you get older, you just tend to slow down, and that's the reality of life. Now, whether it's in your mid-70s or 80s, you know, it varies between individuals, and there's some, you know, 95-year-olds tearing around like 21-year-olds. Good luck to them. But the majority of us, by the time we get to 75, we tend to slow down. And what we see, Phil, is typically a decline of about 30% in the cost of living then. And then the next trigger is if you're part of a couple, when one member of the couple goes, then that will decline by a further 25%, so or 25% of whatever that figure is then. So I guess the point is this. And then the other thing that we need to take into account is what's your end game? Is the plan to leave the kids a fortune? And good luck to you. And maybe there's an argument for doing some of that now rather than waiting 20 or 30 years when they actually need it. Or the other one is, you know, spend the last dollar on the last day. Well, we'd all love to do that. But I think most people take the view that, well, whatever's left for the kids, they can have. But you know what? I'm going to have a good time because I'm not going to be here for a long time. And, you know, my retirement's going to be enjoyed. And as I've said before, kids will tell you. You know, most kids will say, Mom, Dad, we don't want your money. Thank you. You know, you've given us the education. You've given us the upbringing. Enjoy your retirement. That's what I hear from most people. So I just counsel people regularly to not think that, you know, you need that couple of million bucks. Sure, it gives you the choices. It allows you to retire. It allows you to help the kids out. But, you know, the old myth, the million-dollar myth, as I like to call it, just doesn't apply. And again, $350,000, $400,000 for a couple these days gives them a really good retirement, doing all the things that you think you'd want to do, travel.
That's the point, you know. Isn't it? Yeah, that's right. You know, although the question is you have to make some judgment as to how long you're going to last, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's right. The idea is not to end retirement with the same amount that you started with.
No. And funnily enough, though, you know, we talk about this and I see people and, you know, we go marching along and you get to a point when you say to them, well, look, you know, in the projections, we started with 400,000 and by now you should have had 300,000. Miraculously, it's still 400, Phil, you know. Oh, yeah, Nick, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure I want to spend it. But they still do spend it. So when we get booming market times, like we've got in the last 6 months or so here in Australia with shares, that's when they're cashing in. And that's why your caravan people will tell you they can't keep up with the demand. And hopefully soon it'll be the travel people that say they can't keep up with the demand as people cash in some of those earnings and spend them on a good time.
Yes, if you wanted the caravan, it might be a good idea to wait 12 months, I reckon.
Man, after my own heart, Phil.
I reckon there's going to be a lot of vans for sale.
I reckon there will. And white Pajeros, you know.
I reckon, and maybe Land Cruisers, I'm not sure, because they tend to hold their value, those things, but I bet you when people think, gee, I'm sick of that van in my driveway, I'm sick of that van in my driveway, we've done the trip, we've done the lap, and, you know.
Or my the wife, he'll say, I've had enough of the millions of stars, I want 5 stars. But anyway, funnily enough, I've got a mate that who's telling me that his caravan business mate is actually expanding his second-hand lot in anticipation. So he's put in an extra 12 bays for exactly that.
Yep. All right. Look, a lot of Australians have received extra payments from the government over the last couple of years, but you've been writing about a case that shows why you need to be on top of your records.
Phil, this is a really, really sad story, but it is a message for everyone that's on a Centrelink benefit. And we're not talking about people that are getting the full pension. So what we're talking about, someone that's getting a single $967.50 a fortnight or less. This is who we're talking to. And for couples, $1,458.60 a fortnight or less, which means they're being affected by means testing. Now, this story is, I'll very briefly explain it. The gentleman has an investment property, went to Centrelink back in 2016 and gave them all the information, including any loans and stuff he had on there. Now, as it turns out, whoever typed in the numbers on the Centrelink computers made an error And it was a significant error, $70,000. In other words, he had assets that were $70,000 less than what Centrelink thought they had. Now, the result of that was that he lost $210, he and his good wife, $210 a fortnight over the last 5 years, right? So we're talking $20,000 plus. He goes into Centrelink in March this year to update his records. And the person helping him very kindly points out, hey, something's wrong here. You know, there's an error. We've made a mistake. It's $70,000 out. The gentleman contacts Centrelink, gets a complaint going and all those sorts of things. And the ruling comes back, tough bickies. And here's the ruling, Phil. If you don't pick up the error within 13 weeks of it being made, then you're stuck. You're gone.
Really?
He has no claim back from Centrelink on the $20,000 he's missed out on. However, let me say that if you've made an error where they've overpaid you, that doesn't matter. Centrelink will be on your case like a flash, which is, Services Australia, which is, to me, it seems an awfully one-sided arrangement. Now, the gentleman and anyone in this position can actually appeal through the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. There is a scheme called the CDDA, which is a short version for Compensation Detriment Caused by Defective Administration Scheme, and hopefully they'll get compensation paid through that arrangement. But, you know, it's another world of pain you've got to go through for a mistake that was made by whoever it was in Centrelink. And, you know, they're just not giving him the dough, which I just think's outrageous. It seems awfully one-sided.
Well, I agree. Yeah, I agree. I agree. All right.
So check your records. Check your records. It's a message, yeah.
Exactly. All right. Nick Bruning's with us, independent financial advisor. Thanks for that text, by the way. I feel the sense of shock and emptiness which has enveloped Western Australian ABC. Yeah. Listeners, profound. Russ... talking about Russell Wolfe here was such a wonderful and much loved human, devastating. I fully agree, as I said at the beginning of the show.
And I just want to add my condolences. Yeah. Let me say that Russell was a huge part of the Perth mix, if you like. The outpouring of grief today has been just extraordinary, Phil, over here. And what surprised me was the cross media condolences that came through from every channel and every radio station. It's just devastating news. So, yeah. Yep. I guess Russell, I knew him pretty well. He would want everyone to take the message, enjoy life, because he certainly did, and embrace it while you're here.
Yeah. Raise a glass to your old son. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good on you. Let's take a call or two. Alice is first up tonight. Hello, Alice.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad.
Hey, Alice.
Reverse mortgages, Alice.
Yes, reverse mortgage. Centrelink have got a loan very similar, and then there's the banks. Do you know which is better?
Well, we've got to be very careful about sort of singling out anyone, but let me explain the pension loan scheme and why I like that in preference. There are some disadvantages, but basically the pension loan scheme is effectively Josh Frydenberg's or the government's reverse mortgage. And effectively what you're able to do is access up to 150% of the pension, either as a single or a couple. So that means, for example, a single person could access around about $36,000, I suppose, over a year, and a couple up to about $57,000 over a year. Now, up until last year, you could only access it on a fortnightly basis. But now you're able to access some of it as a lump sum, which is good too. So you can have a bit of a lump sum as well as an ongoing amount. When you compare it to a commercial reverse mortgage, Alice, what you find is that the interest rate is generally less. Centrelink, I think, charge 4.25%, or the government charges 4.25%, whereas a commercial reverse mortgage will be about 5% from the last time I looked, 5.25%. The other thing is that Centrelink won't also have all these charges and inspection fees and stuff. And what I've seen with a lot of commercial reverse mortgages is that that there are other costs that seem to get added to the loan along the way, which means that by the time it comes to pay it back, you've got the original borrowings plus the interest that's accumulated, and we get compound interest there, plus any charges. Whereas on the Centrelink pension loan scheme arrangement, it's just the interest costs. So that's quite a big difference there that can be in fees. I like to use reverse mortgages, Alice, when there's no other resource to draw on. The compound interest story says that the longer you've got one running, the greater the impact will be on the final payout. Because how they work is you never have to make a payment until you get you sell the house or move out. Yeah, and then they basically, whatever comes from the proceeds of the sale of the house goes back to the reverse mortgage provider. So the longer you're in it, the bigger the loan is to be repaid. The other thing to consider in the reverse mortgage story, Alice, is that while we'd all like to think that we'll shuffle off this mortal coil in our own home, many cases we end up moving into an aged care facility, and that aged care facility often needs a thing called a refundable accommodation deposit. We used to call it a bond, and the proceeds of the house sale sometimes pay for the bond. So again, if the reverse mortgage is built up to being quite a big debt, then there might not be enough to pay the full cost of the accommodation deposit. So a few things to think about, Alice, but the pension loan scheme is a pretty good arrangement. It's perhaps not as flexible as the commercial ones, but there are definitely more costs involved.
Okay.
Well, that's good. Thank you for your help.
Thanks, Alice.
No problem.
And good luck with your decision. Phil from Newcastle. G'day, Phil.
Hello. How are you going?
Pretty well. What's up?
Okay. I'm 59. I own a house that I'm not living in. My son's been renting it for the last couple of years, and I've been giving him cheap rent. And he's finally bought a house himself.
Good on him.
So in the new year, I'll have a house that I could sell or I could rent it out. And I was wondering, because I'm still working, and if I rent it out, I'm going to have to pay tax. But because I've only got $5,000 in my super account, if I put the rent or my half of my rent and my missus puts her half into super, would we have to pay tax?
No. Well, that's the good thing, Phil. So the first thing to decide, do you own your own home? Is this an investment property that your son lives in?
No, it's my own home, and I own it outright. Basically, I think I owe about $1,000 on it.
Where are you living, Phil?
I'm in North Lambton in Newcastle.
No, but
you asked the question, Phil. Yeah. We're on the same.
Phil, where are you actually living? You're renting somewhere, are you?
No, my wife has a package with her employment, so she gets a car and a house.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
Okay. So when she finishes work, Phil, would you move back into that house?
Well, she doesn't want to. She wants to move into another house.
Oh, okay. All right. But you might buy another house. So this, what I'm trying to establish, if this house is surplus to requirements ultimately, or whether you're going to live in it.
Well, it's not surplus because we would have to sell it to get another house. Or
we could
buy another house now maybe, but at 60 to get a $500,000 or $600,000.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, okay. Well, let's get back to your question. So I was just trying to weevil in all sorts of different mixed scenarios in here. But, okay, so the good news is, yes, you can absolutely pay money into super, and if it's the proceeds from the rent, it's absolutely tax deductible, up to a maximum of $27,500 per annum, which includes what the boss is paid in, Phil. So if your boss is paying in the normal 10% and you're paying some money through salary sacrifice, then providing all of that doesn't go over $27,500, you're perfect. Legal. You mentioned you've only got $5,000 in super. The good news is that if you haven't made use of that, well, it used to be $25,000 over the last 3 years or so. If you haven't made use of that, then you can actually put a little bit more in to bring it up to that $27,500 and catch up the stuff that you missed out on in the previous 3 years. So it'd be worth having a chat to your super fund. But yes, that way you avoid tax. Understand that if you paid into super and claim a tax deduction for it, there is a thing called a contributions tax, which comes out at 15%, but that's almost always going to be less than the income tax you'd pay if you got it in your hot little hand.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm self employed, so
yep.
I don't have a boss. I don't, and I'm not paying anything into super.
Yeah, well, it's a great time to do it if you're debt free, and clearly you are, and there's a bit of surplus money now that your son's moved on, and it's just you and your wife. Then you're in business, so you can put money in, and she'd be in a similar position that she could put money into super if she chooses to. What sort of incomes are you guys on?
Well, I'm on about $70,000 a year, and she's on an allowance. Okay, so she doesn't get a lot of money because she gets a car, she gets some bills paid and the house.
Okay, so, all right. Well, again, talk to the super fund, but there might be a way where you can pay money into a little bit of money into her super fund, only $3,000, and it could boost your tax refund by $540. You might talk to her super fund. It's called the spouse contribution offset, and it applies to low-income earners.
Awesome.
A few things to look into. There you go.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, good on you.
For sure. Yep. Thank you.
Bye-bye. No worries. Thanks to Nick. Susan's on the line. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Hi, guys. How are you?
Well. Good.
I'm thinking about putting some funds away for my grandchildren. They're in primary school right now, but obviously they'll be going into high school, but more than likely they'll be going into boarding school. So you don't see much change out of about $30,000 a year.
No. Yeah.
So what's the best way to put funds aside for that particular purpose?
So there's a couple of ways that you could do it. Probably the easiest way is to effectively set up what's called a bare trust. So essentially, Susan opens up an investment account in each of the grandchildren's names. And you might actually have one of their parents as the trustee. So that's in case something happens to you. Now, essentially, the way the tax office looks at this stuff is providing the parents don't derive any benefit from that investment. So we're talking about perhaps you putting it into a share fund or something like that. It can be a bank account, a share fund, whatever you like. Providing the parent doesn't derive any benefit from that fund, then when the child gets to 18, you can generally transfer it into their name free of capital gains tax and all that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, but the thing is, I wanted to pay their
along the way.
Fees, every year so that the parents didn't have to do that.
So your easiest way is to just simply do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The thing is they're not already at that age.
All right,
like
so then
going to be in another 3 or 4 years' time.
Yeah, okay. So you could
need to put those funds into.
Okay, so for that sort of then in that case, you're probably perhaps better off having it in your name. I'm flipping about a bit here. And then
I don't mind having it in my name.
Okay, and then you can derive some benefits and stuff from that. Are you likely to receive a pension, Susan, or not? So you just set up a fund. Do you have shares or any of those sorts of investments at the moment?
There are some shares there, but I'm just, I'm not really a great share person. I don't know, I suppose.
All right. So the other alternative might be what we call an exchange traded fund. I'm trying to get you the cheapest option of doing it, Susan.
Yeah.
And that would be an exchange traded fund, which you can buy via the share market. You can get mixtures of investments in that. You can have shares and fixed interest type stuff. I suppose the third thing is to go and see a financial advisor about setting up a fund on that basis, and they will set it up on the basis that you'll be drawing money out on a regular basis as well as probably feeding it in. So it's a case of sort of building it up over the next 4 years to allow it to be taken out once they hit boarding school, isn't it? Yeah.
What about, there's another thing called endowment warrants or something
like that? Well, all of those sorts of things are tax-paid investments, and these are the sorts of education products that have been out for many, many years, and they work off bonds and all sorts of complicated things. What I find, Susan, with a lot of that is that the tax benefits that they talk about aren't quite as good as everyone makes out, but I also find that the fees and the costs tend to erode them quite a bit. And, and with interest rates so low at the moment, they tend to be invested fairly conservatively. You end up, by the time you're paying your costs, with virtually nothing, and that's why these alternatives like exchange-traded funds and maybe seeing a financial advisor that's independent and can give you, wholesale sorts of funds would be a better option for you.
I've got some money in a La Trobe mortgage fund.
We don't like to talk about products, but I'd probably personally look at alternatives to that. I like the looks of, some of those bigger, broader funds. Sometimes there's nothing wrong with putting it in the bank. The third option you might do is give it to your kids and tell them to pay it off the mortgage, and then they can use it to pay the kids' school fees.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
All right, Susan. Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right.
No worries.
Yeah.
Some thoughts there. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Darren's on the road. G'day, Darren.
How are you?
No, good.
Look, without going into the nitty-gritty, I basically bought a property, resold it a month later, made quite good money out of it. The way it turned out, initially I wasn't going to buy it with my SMSF. It turned out that I had to. Mm-hmm. I put $20,000 of my own funds in as the initial deposit, then ultimately paid for the whole thing with my SMSF, and then the profit will go back to my SMSF. My question is, how do I treat the 20 grand that I put in initially for the deposit on the property, because my SMS hadn't been set up at that stage because of some problems I was having with the ATO. Mm. Can I take it back out, or can I leave it in there even though it was put in before my SMSF was set up, and then claim that as deduction off my income this year?
In fact, the question like this came up before, I seem to recall a few months ago. Look, it's about the establishment date, and I think you'll find that, it's just going to be regarded not as a contribution because it wasn't made when the fund was set up. It's as simple as that. So what have the ATO said? Have you had a ruling on this at all?
I haven't asked them. So could I basically get my SMSF to pay the 16 grand, sorry, the 20 grand back?
Well, not
back in again.
Well, in fact, it shouldn't have gone in the first place. I think that's what it boils down to. So it was an invalid contribution because the fund didn't exist at the time. It's a tricky one. I don't know the answer. But look, how much have you paid into super, or what year did it occur? That's the other thing. It occurred last financial year.
I bought and sold the property this financial year. I'm well under my. I've got unused contributions that I could tear it off again.
Well, I think probably the fund has to return the 20 grand to you, and then it gets recontributed back into your scheme this year. I think that's how it's going to have to work.
As long as I can do that, that's fine.
Yeah. This is one where you need to get some advice, and I'm not I'm self-confessed no guru in self-managed super fund, particularly with these tricky things like that. You can, and just for anyone that has issues with uncertainty out of the tax office, there is a mechanism to get a private ruling from the ATO. If you've got scenarios that just no one seems to be able to answer, you can actually write to them, set it all out. Some people use their accountant to do it, but there's nothing to stop anyone doing it. Setting it all out, you can send it into the tax office, and they'll come back with a ruling which is binding on them and on you, and then you've got your question answered.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Darren. Good on you. Bye-bye. Thanks for the call. Bella's got some shares. Hello, Bella.
Oh, hello, Philip and your guest. Look, I just want to ask a question about some shares that I want to leave in my will to my nieces and nephews. Mm-hmm. The story is I'm one of five siblings, and when my mother died in 1993, she had 100 Commonwealth Bank shares, and they were divided between each of us. Right. And they've increased in value quite a bit in that time. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, would it be sensible with my nieces and nephews, of which I have also had five, to divide them equally between them in my will? I'm on a dividend reinvestment plan with them, and I'm not reliant on them at all for my own income.
Okay.
I think that would be consistent with what my mother did with her own
children. Oh, no, that's terrific, Bella. Bella, can I just ask, I think you mentioned that your mum originally bought 100 shares that were divided between five. So presumably you inherited 20. How many shares do you have now?
I should be able to tell you that.
Oh, well, roughly.
I think 30-something.
Oh, okay. So then all you need to do is give the instructions to your solicitor or your lawyer when they're drawing up the will that says, yes, you divide all of my shares equally between my grandchildren and they're named, and then on that basis.
Nieces and nephews.
Oh, nieces and nephews, whatever.
Have any
yeah. Okay. So nieces and nephews, you know, divided equally between nieces and nephews that survive me, and then it's pretty easy to do. In fact, you know, have you updated your will recently, or you're about to do it?
Reasonably
or?
Recently, but I'm about to do it again.
Oh, okay. Well, just instruct your solicitor to make that provision, and that's a lovely gift to them.
Yeah.
Mind you, Bella. Thank you. And carry on the family tradition as an innocent.
Yeah. Well, there's plenty of assets like that that seem to pass through.
Yeah. Now, Alan's on the line. Hello, Alan.
Hello there. How are you?
Very well. You've got an investment property.
Well, yes. Well, my situation is I've got two investment properties, but the investment properties were bought by my kids using their deposit. Mm-hmm. They put the deposit in, but they couldn't. They're only working part time. They couldn't borrow enough money. So, I have a Commonwealth Super Scheme pension, and I'm working part time. So I was able to get the loans. Now I need to sell the properties. Now I'm getting to the near retirement, and I want to sell both properties too, so I can maybe even get a healthcare card. And I just don't know how to.
Okay, so is it? Go on.
Sorry, that was it.
Yeah. Okay. So, Alan, the two properties they're in. So the title deed says they're in your names. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
What did you pay for them?
One's gone up in about 100. I paid 400 for one, and or about 400 for both. But one's gone up by 100. One's gone down by 100.
Oh, so one's made your money, and the other's lost your money.
Yes, but only one wants to sell at the moment. One's in the situation where she wants to move on, and I'm thinking, well, I have to sell both. I'm just trying to work out a way.
Yeah, no,
to do
that's
it.
Fine. Well, here's the thing: if you sell the property that's fallen in value by $100,000, right?
Yeah.
That loss stays in your tax record, right? So even if you don't sell the other property this year, you've got that loss that'll stay stuck. So when you sell the other property and make $100,000 bucks, you've got $100,000 capital loss to offset it against. So bingo, net gain zero. Yep. If you sell the property that's made money this year, then you've got $100,000 capital gain. Now, because you've held it for more than 12 months, $50,000 will be added to your other income for this financial year. So my question to you, Alan, is how old are you?
I'll be 66 in Feb next year.
Right.
I've got 66 and a half. I've got to, when I retire, when I get a pension.
And can I ask how much you got in your super?
I get a pension each fortnight.
Right, but you got
I'm in the CSS, so I get a
Commonwealth pension scheme. Yeah. Well, the good news is I reckon that you can probably make use of the non-concessional contribution carryover rule, which would allow you to put in, probably the $50,000 and claim that as a tax deduction into a super scheme. Now, you can pick any super scheme, frankly, and you'd be able to make use of that to get rid of the capital gain if you sell the one that's made money. Well, or the other thing is if you do sell both this year, then the $100,000 loss will be offset against the $100,000 gain and your net position will be nil.
So the best to sell the one that's going to lose first and then...
Well, maybe,
does that have to be a year apart or just have to be the same year?
No. All I'm saying is if you sold the one that's made a profit this year and don't sell the one that's made a loss, you got a bit of a tax thing you got to look at. If you sell them both, then you won't.
Yeah, because I mean, neither property has. I mean, my son and daughter, because they're working, they've paid all the payments. I've not made any payments. It's just the fact that they couldn't borrow the money because they're working part time. Yeah,
tax office doesn't care about that. Well, make sure you.
It was good at the time, but it's come back to haunt me now.
many things we do for our kids, Alan, come back to haunt you.
All right, mate. Thanks. Jim says, hang on, where's the property that's lost value this year?
Yes, good point.
Jim, they haven't gone up everywhere. Yeah, that's true.
No, Sophie in depends Richmond, on when you bought.
Hmm. Yeah. Sophie in Richmond on the text line says, hi there, I'm 35, never had a will. Should I see a solicitor to get a will drawn up or just use the one from the newsagent?
Oh, boy, our lawyers all go screaming, use us.
The newsagent one's okay.
Look, my personal view is this, that if your affairs are really straightforward and you're simply going to leave your estate to your siblings.
All to mum or all to me, brother.
Exactly. The will kit's fine. Where it gets messy is where you've got investments and where you've got secondary relationships. So if there's a partner and kids from a previous relationship, or there's, you know, an estranged child or something like that, absolutely go and see a lawyer. But if it's really a Mickey Mouse type setup, well, I don't say Mickey Mouse, I mean, it's dead simple, where it's, as you say, going to the mum, going to dad, going to brothers and sisters equally, then a will kit will do the job. But even Sophie at 35 should also look at doing an enduring power of attorney, which is the document that allows you to appoint someone to manage your affairs if you're unable to, perhaps through illness or through an accident. Absolutely crucial, as important as a will. And the second document, and in some states they're combined, is a thing called the enduring power of guardianship. And it's different to the power of attorney, Phil, because the power of attorney deals with the business stuff. The guardianship actually deals with the lifestyle clauses. And I can give you a perfect example. I had a friend who was the enduring power of attorney, using that authority, sold her friend's house because of dementia and went to put her into an aged care facility. Unfortunately, she couldn't because she wasn't the legal guardian. And that was the whole idea of the enduring power of guardianship. Had to go to the court and get it all set up. So three things we should all do. The will, tick that, the enduring power of attorney, and the enduring power of guardianship. Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right. Still on the text line. I want to give money to my daughter and son-in-law and watch them enjoy it. How much can I give before I incur being taxed with gift duty?
This is the best question. You can give as much as you want.
There's no gift duty. There's nothing.
I'll tell you how it works. So this whole thing of gifting comes from the Centrelink aspect of things, and it says that you can't deprive yourself of assets in order to get more benefits from Centrelink. Hmm. You can reduce your assets legitimately by $10,000 per year with a maximum of 30 over 5. If you give more away, that's fine, no problem. Guess what? We're not going to reduce. We're not going to give you more pension because of that until 5 years has passed. Where it gets a bit messy. So the easiest way to give money or things away is just straight cash. Where it gets messy, Phil, is if you give an asset away, perhaps a block of land or a house or some shares, the problem there is that when you give it away, it's deemed to be a disposal as far as the tax and the capital gains tax laws are concerned. So that disposal triggers a capital gains tax event, and you have to pay capital gains tax on the profit you've made. And whether or not Junior pays the tax is irrelevant. It's a disposal, and you have to get a property, in this case, assessed at market value by a licensed valuer. If it's shares, it's done on the day of the gift based on the closing share price of the shares. So there's no getting away from the capital gains tax. But if you want to give away as much as you can, feel free. If it's cash, no problem. If it's an asset, then you potentially have capital gains to consider.
Yes, but enjoy, Maggie. That's right.
Yes.
Give away as much as you want.
I'll give you my phone number, Maggie.
dear. Mary says, can you explain a bit more about ETFs? Can one be set up that pays out a certain amount, say, each month?
Some can. Look, it depends a bit. Often some of the funds are held by a platform, which is a sophisticated way for talking about a glorified spreadsheet that some stockbroking firms and financial planning firms operate. And under those platforms, you can set them up to pay a regular amount out. So, yeah, they can actually absolutely be set up. So, in effect, what happens is a portion of the ETF is sold off on a regular basis in order to fund those regular payments, if that's the way you want to go.
Hmm. Alrighty, let's get back to some calls. Sarah's got a self-managed super fund. G'day, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Yep. So, my husband and I, we are 52 and 54. We have a self-managed super fund, and currently we have just shares in our self-managed super fund, which are not really paying dividends. So we're wondering how can we, we're still working, however, we're looking at hopefully stopping around about 60. How can we change that into property so that we can get a cash flow, like for rent or something like that, once we retire? Well, I guess we're looking at what are the tax implications of selling those shares now, or do we have to wait until we actually physically stop work?
No. So, again, this is all about the phase or operation of your self-managed super fund. So in the superannuation sphere, if you like, we've got two phases of operation. Accumulation phase is when we're building assets up and we're parking the money for retirement. Now, in that phase, the super fund pays tax at 15% on any earnings that it makes, which will include stuff like capital gains and things like that. Once we get into retirement phase, and that's when we convert it into a thing like an account-based pension, the beaut part about that is it moves from being taxed at 15% to being taxed at nil, right? So I guess that's the thing. Do you wait until you get to retirement phase and then make the switch then, or do you sell some shares now and use that money to buy the properties? I'm presuming that at 52, Sarah, you guys are still contributing to the super?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
Yeah. So what you might do is start to build up the money in the self-managed super fund so that you can get enough there to then invest in property as well. And so you'd end up with the best of both worlds. And that's actually not a bad strategy because you'd probably want a bit of diversification. What one of the big concerns about a lot of self-managed super funds is a very concentrated risk of assets. And, you know, if you switched everything to property, that's probably a bit risky too because you tend to tie all your money up in the one thing. The one good thing about your shares is that, you know, they're very liquid, aren't they? You can sell them whenever you want, but you can't sell off a bedroom, as we say. So that might be a better strategy. Do you use someone to help you sort out your self-managed fund, Sarah, or do you do it by yourself?
No, that's the problem. We do it by ourselves and we sort of feel like we're stuck because we don't really know what to do, but we don't kind of want to put it in the hands of somebody else who's just going to take all our money and
rip your blind.
So we're kind of stuck.
Okay. Well, I'll put a mini plug in for the profession of independent financial advisors, PIFA.org.au, which are guys and girls that don't get their money based on how big your deal is, right? So they're not prohibited from commissions or fees based on how much money you've got. It's flat fees. That's the rules for being in that association. There's not many, but they're worth looking up, and that way you're not going to get sold something. Now, that said, that might be the way to go about it is to build up some cash reserves, and then you can look at looking at investing in property there. But look, it is probably something to get a bit of advice on, and it might be a case of seeing one of the independent guys and just giving you some guidance about how to go about it, and then that's it. Because if they're charging you a flat fee for the advice, then that's it, and you know you might not see them again for 5 or 10 years.
And what were they called? Sorry,
I'm one of them. Profession of Independent Financial Advisors. PIFA.org.au is the website. There's only 200 or 300 of us in the country, so you know we're a rare breed. flat fees, and we don't care how much we're investing. It's all about the strategy and getting the getting that right, and that's clearly what you're after. You don't want someone to sell you something.
Okay. And as you're saying now, sorry, just before you go, and as you're saying now, if we were to sell anything now, we're still paying 15%.
Well, it gets a little complicated. Let's say that 15% tax on the profit.
Okay. No, lovely. Thanks, Sarah.
A pleasure, and good luck going forward. My elderly neighbour had a will professionally done by a legal firm. Sons were estranged and left out of the will at the deceased's wish. I'm seriously questioning why bother with wills when the deceased's wishes are not honoured other than keeping the government away from the estate. I am the executor. Well, we've had our lawyer on the program about this matter, actually, and if you leave kids out of wills, they can challenge. And you need to, I think, to summarise his advice, I mean, love yours too, Nick. I mean, I think he said, look, this will only work if you really explain why it's happened.
Yeah, there needs to be a backstory.
That's right.
In the will, and that's what I've heard too. Look, the other thing too, Phil, is that, you know, there's nothing to stop you giving money away before you go.
Die. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, people sort of question that, but the irony is that you end up getting all the money at the wrong end of life. People in their 70s and 80s inherit money from grandma and mums and dads.
They don't need it then. No.
They don't need it, and they've got kids and grandkids that are struggling. And okay, you might want to put some conditions so you don't look like you're the ultimate ATM. I'm very big on if I'm in a position to help my kids out when they need it.
It was put to me by as an idea, not to me personally. Someone suggested the idea the other day that just apropos of that idea, that given the high property prices that have, you know, I mean, there are people, of course, if you owned a house, you've, you know, you've enjoyed this, this windfall in a way over the last 10 years or so, that they were wondering in this low interest rate environment whether or not you might help your kids out this way by borrowing, you know, like quite a large amount of money on the house, including the interest required to pay it off. Give the kids the capital sum. You'd have the money to pay the interest. That would obviously be a debt on the house. But the kids would get the money when they needed it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like a reverse mortgage, the ultimate reverse mortgage, isn't it? Yeah. What troubles me there, Phil, is you just don't know what life dishes up.
You don't know what's going to happen with interest rates either.
No. Well, there's that. You don't know what's going to happen with house prices. And look, like, you know, I'm seeing some analysis done by some economists talking about a glut in housing and what that might do to house prices next year and beyond. The other thing is relationships with kids. And sadly, I don't know what the statistics are, but you might end up handing over a whole lot of money that ends up going to an ex-partner, that can be very, very upsetting for people in that situation. So, look, it's always about individual circumstances, but I just make that point again that, you know, sometimes helping your kids out can help them out, importantly, and can help you out too in the long run too, because often you ultimately end up being entitled to benefits. And that's, I should have made that point more clear. If you give something away, 5 years to the day, Centrelink drop it off the system. That's the way.
But it is worth thinking about, is like giving kids something before you die, rather than how do you spell that website again?
PIFA stands for the Profession of Independent Financial Advisors.
PIFA.org.au,
and you can type in your state, and it'll give you the names of guys and girls who are independent advisors around you.
Jeff says, Phil, besides having a will, et cetera, do you need to have an advanced care directive? I mean, I think you'd say yes. Well, you do.
Yeah, and just to explain what that is, the advanced care directive sets out the medical interventions you want under different circumstances. In some states, the enduring power of guardianship gives the rights to the guardian to make medical decisions. But if you like, the advanced health directive hierarchically sits above the EPG, the guardianship document. So if you like, that overrides it. And if you've said, look, you know, if I'm comatose, then, turn off the switch, that would supersede what the guardian decides.
Jeff, hello.
G'day, gentlemen. How are you?
Well.
That's good. Look, I've got a self-managed super fund with my wife, and we own a holiday rental in a fairly remote place. We're seeking some advice in regards to, we know we can't stay there for holidays, no issues with that, but there's times where we need to go there and stay somewhere in order to perform maintenance on the place. There's no tradesmen within close locality, so general handyman work, cleaning up, that sort of stuff needs to be done frequently. What are the rules in regards to that for us as the trustees of the self-managed super?
Short answer, I don't know. it is a bit of a grey area, isn't it? Because you're quite right. And under the self-managed superannuation fund rules, you can't personally make use of an asset, which means that even the people invest in artworks and collectibles, the irony is you can't hang it up in your wall. It's got to be kept in storage or somewhere else. So you certainly can't enjoy it. So I guess the argument would be, you know, reasonable person, how many weeks are you there for, Jeff? Is it there for a week and a half once a year to sort it out, or does it turn out to be 8, 9, 10 weeks, in which case I reckon the tax office might go, well, what's going on here?
It's a question. 10 weeks, it'd be a couple. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe in a year that's probably reasonable. Look, at the end of the day, if it gets questioned by the auditor, you need to be able to substantiate to see I was here doing this, and here's the receipts for the work and the paint and whatever. Facebook photos of you with crayfish pop up, then you're probably in trouble.
Jeff. Thanks, Matt. Bye bye. Gavin. Hello, Gavin.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad.
I just had a little bit of a question. I've been lucky enough to buy some shares. I have probably about 300,000 shares and about probably 50K in crypto. But there's sort of been a lot of talk about the market is sort of very overheated at the moment and a bit what they call a bit of a code red. And it might be just some of the the market out there or advisors sort of pushing their own agenda, but I just thought, what was your thoughts about that?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I guess I sit in the camp where I look at some fundamental numbers about where share prices are at the moment, and I must say that I'm a bit concerned about levels of equity prices, and we look at things like price earnings multiples, and I guess some of the things that could affect share prices going forward. And one of the things, the reasons that share prices shot up so high is because the cost of money's almost free. I mean, it's cheap as chips, you know, the cash rate, whatever. You really are starting to see some inflationary effects moving in from the United States. And in fact, as before I came on air, Phil, I was looking at the 10-year Treasury bond in the US, which is kind of a bit of an international benchmark about where interest rates are heading. So 4 weeks ago, it sat at 1.3. It's now at 1.65. So in terms of magnitude, that's quite a steep increase. And I think that's probably why markets have been pretty flat over the last, you know, if you look at it from June end of the financial year to now, here we are end of October, it's about 1% higher or something. And at one point, it was down 3 or 4%. So it's pretty much flat. I just think people are sitting on the side waiting to see what happens next. My feeling is that we're probably looking at higher interest rates next year because of those inflationary effects, but who knows? So the secret, take some profits, stay in the share market, but don't be scared to take those profits that you've made and perhaps put them into something safe. And if I'm right and it goes down, you can buy in cheaper. And if I'm wrong and it goes up, I'm an idiot, but you can cash in shares later on too.
Mm.
No, it is. Like you said, it's all a bit of a gamble, I suppose. But yeah.
All right, Gav, good luck with it. Good luck with your crypto.
Yes, well, I didn't go there, did I, Phil?
No,
I'm not a big fan of that.
I noticed that.
It's a bet.
It is a bet, yes. Mm. It is a bet. It's a very odd thing indeed. But then again, the share market's a very odd place too. If Tesla can be the most highly valued car company in the world, I don't understand it.
But they still make cars, Phil, and they've still got factories and stuff. But what's behind crypto? Nothing.
Nothing. Yes, fair enough. All right, Nick, great to talk with you as always.
Thanks, Philip.
On you, Nick. Thanks.
Cheers.
Bye.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.